And I'm going to start off by giving you a bit of an overview of what the field is about, because maybe you're not so familiar with it. And I'm going to tell you how this connects with what we're going to be doing in the course. So there's many ways you could do this, but one useful classification is in terms of what sorts of activities happen in the field. What do people spend their time doing? So one activity is trying to provide an adequate interpretation of the quantum formalism. So there's actual disagreement about what the elements of the mathematical formalism of quantum theory represent. And people attempt to come up with schemes for how we should think about this formalism. What does a quantum state represent, for example? What's the picture of the world that quantum theory gives us? Another activity is to explore non-classical phenomena. So there are certain aspects of quantum theory that appear very surprising from the perspective of a classical worldview. And so people try to come up with more examples of these and to find the connections among various phenomena that are classically surprising. So in this category would be things like, Bell's theorem appears to be a non-classical phenomena, or quantum interference phenomena are difficult to explain classically. And then there's sort of more exotic versions, such as things like the quantum Zeno effect you may have heard of, or something called the quantum eraser experiment. And there's a long list of experiments that people have devised where the results are surprising from a classical perspective. But again, there's debate here. It really, to some extent, depends on how you interpret quantum theory, whether a given phenomena is really genuinely novel from a classical perspective or not. And then finally, another activity which is really prominent these days is to try to find some principles from which you might derive the formalism of quantum mechanics. So let me say a couple of words about that. If you look at the history of relativity theory, prior to Einstein's 1905 work, we already knew about the Lorentz transformations. And Einstein's accomplishment was to derive the Lorentz transformations from a couple of principles of physics. So the relativity principle and the principle that the speed of light is independent of the speed of source. And you could say that once you have that derivation of the Lorentz transformations, you understand better their content. You could also say, for example, that it's hard to imagine that Einstein could have derived general relativity so early had he not understood the content of the Lorentz transformations in terms of these principles. So there is a sense in which it's very useful to replace mathematical assumptions with physical assumptions. Because once you have a set of logically independent physical axioms, you can start modifying them to see what the consequences are. So you can explore perhaps alternative theories by modifying the independent axioms of your current theory. So general relativity involved modifications of the principles of special relativity. So the situation in quantum mechanics is that we have a mathematical formalism, which you could think of as analogous to the Lorentz transformations. And the question is, could we find a few simple physical principles from which we derive the mathematical formalism? So you could ask questions like, why is it that the quantum states are defined in a Hilbert space as opposed to some other space? And why is it a Hilbert space over the complex field as opposed to the real field or the quaternionic field? You could also ask why systems composed by tensor product as opposed to some other product. So there's all these elements of the formalism that are just given to us essentially as postulates, but it would be nice to have some more physical principles that tell us that it has to be that way. Or if it doesn't have to be that way, what the alternatives are. Okay. So these are the main sorts of activities, but they're tightly interconnected. So as I said before, the interpretation you take will dictate what you think is classical and not classical. Also, when you find some non-classical phenomena, sometimes these are good candidates for principles from which the formalism might be derived. So let me give you an example of that. It happens not to work, but it was a good idea. So we're going to see in the course, and I think you saw in Joseph's course, Bell's theorem, which says that there's a certain sense, there's a certain kind of non-locality in quantum theory. And yet, quantum theory also still obeys the principle that no signals can propagate faster than the speed of light. So there's a kind of tension there. On the one hand, you can't signal faster than the speed of light. On the other hand, Bell's theorem suggests that perhaps there's some causes that go faster than the speed of light, or there's something going on to ensure that you get these very strong correlations. So you could say, well, what if quantum theory is the only theory that has those two features, violates Bell inequalities, but does not admit superluminal signaling? So you could take those two facts as a couple of principles and ask, might it be that the Hilbert space formalism over the complex field with tensor product falls out as the only theory that has those features? Well, it turns out the answer is no. So Popescu and Rohrlich many years ago showed that there are theories that have those two features but aren't quantum mechanics. But it gives you a flavor for what these sorts of principles might be, what the idea of such an axiomatization might be. And then finally, there are many people who believe that to find the correct interpretation of quantum theory, it is useful to try to reformulate quantum theory. So to understand the formalism better by having it derived from a few principles, finishing this project is perhaps a prerequisite to getting the interpretation right. So that's why these days people spend a lot of time on this sort of project. So in this course, what we're going to do is, in the first week, we're going to see a little bit of this axiomatic stuff. In the second week, we're going to be focused on things like Bell's theorem and making precise the way in which quantum theory differs from classical theories. And the third week is going to be a survey of a few different interpretations of quantum theory that are well known. So let me pause and ask if there are any questions about the big picture. No? Okay. So in this lecture, I'm going to start with just textbook quantum mechanics. So I imagine all of you are sort of familiar with a particular kind of version and approach to quantum theory, which is typical of textbooks. And I'm going to ask, well, what's the problem with that? You know, why do we even debate the interpretation of quantum mechanics? What's wrong with what we find in the textbooks? So the way I'm going to do that is by writing down sort of the standard postulates that you'll find in a typical textbook. So this is not from any particular textbook. It's just a distillation of sort of the typical way of presenting quantum theory. And then we'll ask what the problems with this might be. So the first standard postulate I'll call the representational completeness of the quantum state psi. And what it says is that the rays of Hilbert space correspond one-to-one with the physical states of the system. So when I say the rays of Hilbert space, I mean the not just the vector representing the quantum state, right, which in Dirac notation I would denote by this, because this has a phase freedom in it. And variation of that phase doesn't, according to the standard postulates, correspond to a variation of the physical state. It's only the direction in which the vector is pointing that's relevant for the physical state. And so that's the ray in Hilbert space. So the standard postulate is that there's basically, once you've told me the quantum state, you've told me everything about the physical scenario. There's nothing more to say. The second postulate concerns measurements. So it says, first of all, that measurements are associated with Hermitian operators. And if you have a Hermitian operator A with spectral projectors PK, so let me just remind you of that. I presume that you've seen this in the last course. If I diagonalize, block diagonalize the Hermitian operator A, then PK are the spectral projectors, AK are the eigenvalues. Each of these might be just projectors onto a single ray in Hilbert space, or perhaps there's some degeneracy. And so each of these projectors could have rank greater than one. So if the PK are these spectral projectors, then the probability that quantum theory predicts for getting the outcome K in this measurement, so I'm labeling all the eigenvalues of A by some index K, to be a k. So the probability of getting the outcome k is just the expectation value of the projector pk with psi. Okay, so that's familiar. But it also says, typically, that these probabilities are somehow objective, that there's an objective indeterminism in quantum theory, which means that there is nothing in the world that fixes what this outcome is going to be. So if you look at the physical state, say, of the entire past of this measurement, you still won't be able to predict what that measurement outcome is. There's just nothing in the world that fixes it. It's random. Okay, then you have a couple of postulates that tell you about the evolution of systems. So you have different sorts of evolutions depending on whether your system is isolated or whether it's subject to a measurement. So for an isolated system, the postulate says that evolution is by unitary operators. So the quantum state psi evolves to some u times psi, where if there's a fixed Hamiltonian, then it's just the exponentiation of that Hamiltonian for whatever time has passed. And critically, this kind of evolution is deterministic, meaning that if for every initial quantum state, there's a fixed final quantum state under this evolution. And it's continuous, meaning that if I take the limit that the time of evolution is very small, then this unitary becomes well approximated by identity. And then finally, if you look at evolution of systems undergoing measurements, the postulate says the following. So if Hermitian operator A is associated with a measurement, and outcome K is obtained, then the physical state of the system changes very differently from how it did here. It changes discontinuously, making a jump from psi to psi K, where psi K is defined to be the projection of psi into the eigenspace of the kth eigenvalue of A. So that's this pk is the projector onto that eigenspace. And then I just renormalize this state to have length 1. OK, so that's basically the textbook postulates. And over the years, various people have found it fit to complain about these and criticize the standard postulates. And so rather than me standing here tell you what all those standard complaints are, I'm going to open the floor and invite you to tell me what might be problematic about this state of affairs. Sure.
Drawing the artificial distinction between the measurement apparatus and the system that's being measured. And treating them differently, not making clear how you actually treat them both in the same framework.
So, yes, you're saying that measurements seem to play a special role in these postulates.
Yes, they're used as this abstract word. When you do a measurement, this happens. But mm-hmm. at the same time, there's this other description where everything is a quantum system. And you have this dual description, and that's really, and it's not really clear how.
So what would you rather have?
Not use the word measurement.
Not use the word measurement. OK, so one thing you could say is that a measurement device is just another physical system. It's built out of atoms. You might believe it undergoes the same kind of evolution that any other physical system did. So it would be better to have a set of postulates that just tells you how any physical system evolves. And then ask those postulates, well, if the physical system happens to be configured as a measurement device interacting with some system that is measuring, well, what happens in that case? As opposed to building into the postulates themselves a primitive notion of measurement. Yeah, so that's certainly something, a very prominent problem that people have had with these kinds of postulates. Yes?
I guess another question would be, how does a deterministic and continuous process give rise to something that is discontinuous and indeterministic?
Yes. So can you tell me more? Why do these postulates force me to think that something deterministic and continuous must give rise to something discontinuous and indeterministic?
You have your unitary evolution,
yep.
which is what we had. And somehow, you stop measuring things, it breaks down, or you have something very different.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for a moment and try to defend these. What if I just said, well, look, it's clear. You get unitary evolution when the system is not undergoing a measurement, when it's just evolving freely. And you get something else when it's evolving a measurement, but that's a well-defined distinction. You know, why not have two kinds of evolutions as opposed to just one?
Oh, it doesn't actually tell you why, unless that's just fundamental.
True. I guess by the light of these postulates, it is just a sort of fundamental distinction between evolution under measurement and evolution for an isolated system. But it seemed to me you were saying that there's sort of a tension between these postulates. And I'm just curious if you can tell me, is it just that it's inelegant to have two kinds of evolution in one theory, or is there some deeper tension than that?
Ultimately, you'd like to see how that links, rather than have two separate postulates.
So maybe like the first point, it would be nice to know what is a measurement in the language of physical states of systems. You know, what precisely qualifies any given physical interaction to count as a measurement? Something like that.
I suppose so.
Yes?
It doesn't tell me how a non-isolated system that is not a measurement evolves.
Non-isolated system that is not a measurement. Okay. Right, so if I have something that's interacting with something else, but that something else is not a measurement device, how should that evolve? That's true. Now, what we're going to see in week one is a kind of answer to that sort of question. And the way that people have come up with the answer to that question is to say, well, if we look at the larger system that includes the system you're interested in and the environment that it's interacting with, that system can be considered to be an isolated system, right? So as long as I add enough stuff, all the things that are interacting together, I consider that one system, composite system. And then the postulates tell me how that thing evolves. That whole thing evolves unitarily. And then you can deduce from that how the subsystem ought to evolve, given that you know how the composite evolves. So it can ultimately answer that question by appealing to the third postulate applied to a larger system that includes the environment. But that should lead you to a worry about this. Yes?
Objective indeterminism of a measurement's outcome is something to consider, at least in the classical world. We think of each measurement having an outcome that we could predict if we knew enough information about the system. According to these postulates, we can predict probabilities of outcomes, but can't, and just not knowing why one outcome results rather than another outcome can be unsatisfactory.
So you're saying that there's something sort of deeply unsettling about objective indeterminism? It's certainly, from a classical point of view, it's odd that you can't predict something. And you're saying that maybe we should try to eliminate that from quantum theory.
Say a question that comes to mind.
Right.
Or a potential hole to be filled, something to think about.
Yep. Yep. Gotcha.
Yeah, I would say either try to eliminate the indeterminism, find the hidden variable that would allow us to predict what the outcome will be deterministically, or else prove that such a variable can't exist. I suppose that's the two possible ways.
Yeah, you could certainly, from the perspective of just seeing these postulates, you would do well to ask, well, what tells us that this indeterminism here is really objective? So there's two kinds of indeterminism you could have in a theory. The alternative would be a kind of subjective indeterminism. It just means I can't predict what the outcome is, but there might be some matter of fact about the world that fixes what that outcome is, and I simply don't know it. So my lack of knowledge of those degrees of freedom makes it such that I can only predict probabilities for outcomes. But that doesn't mean that there isn't something in the world that fixes those outcomes, such as some hidden variables that aren't specified by the quantum state. So you might ask, well, you know, how do we know that these probabilities really are objective, as opposed to there just being, as opposed to us just facing some ignorance about what we would need to know to predict them?
It doesn't tell us exactly what psi is. It doesn't tell us if it's a state of knowledge or if it's an actual description of the underlying reality of the quantum system, or it doesn't really tell you what it is at all.
That's true. Well, I would say, in a sense, the usual way of interpreting the first postulate is that you should think of psi as a physical state, as describing reality directly. So you could quibble with that. You could say, well, there are alternatives. You know, should we really... You know, what tells us that we have to think of the quantum state that way? Maybe that gets us into trouble. Certainly, in a sense, it has more the flavor of a probability distribution insofar as it predicts probabilities for outcomes of measurements. So that was, you know, like Nicole's point, that it's very odd that you'd have a theory which makes only probabilistic predictions. So if, in fact, the quantum state only described our incomplete knowledge of something deeper, which fixed the outcomes, then we could explain the probabilities that we assign to the outcomes as just being a result of our lack of knowledge of those deeper things. Yes?
So there's this focus always on permission operators and this tie
yes.
between, you know, every measurement has to be some permission operator. So what is it about a measurement that you can't have some sort of a measurement device structured out of non-permission operators?
Yeah, you could, you know, coming back to that question about axiomatization, you might well ask, why are measurements modeled in this way? Is there some deeper reason? And what we'll see this week is actually there is a more general class of measurements that aren't associated with Hermitian operators. Another way to say that is instead of them being associated with a set of projectors, as we have here, they're associated with a set of positive operators at sum to identity. So there is actually a more general class of measurements that are allowed in quantum theory that you don't see in the standard textbooks, but which are used a lot in quantum information theory. So we'll cover that. But I think the more general question is, you know, why do we have this way of modeling measurements at all? These postulates certainly don't answer that question. Yes?
On a similar formal note, the Reyes-Hilbert space correspond to pure states only?
The
rays of Hilbert space.
Yes, they correspond to the pure states only. So that's another thing we're going to see is that a generalization to mixed quantum states and how we should think about those. Yes?
On a more practical note, then it's not clear how classical mechanics arises from this, since there's a totally different set of concepts.
Yeah.
It's concepts more than two numbers.
That's a very good point. If you want to compare quantum theory to classical theory, you sort of need to know what to compare. And so here, for example, it suggests that, you know, because you're associating the Reyes and Hilbert space with the physical states, you should think of these quantum states as being the analog of, say, a point in phase space, which is a complete description of a classical system. But yeah, what we're going to see is that people argue about what the right association between the classical theory and the quantum theory is. So others would say, no, the quantum state is like a distribution over the phase space. But when you get down to here, you know, the concept of isolated systems and systems undergoing measurement is not one that's really primitive in classical theories. So it's not clear how you ought to make a comparison there. And furthermore, I mean, a classical theory, it's certainly, like you said earlier, I mean, it doesn't have the concept of measurement built in at the deepest level. So you might say, well, only if we had a formulation of quantum theory that just really referred to physical systems and their states and their evolution, only then would we really be able to properly compare it to classical theories. Or alternatively, if we reformulated the classical theories to really be about measurements and what happens to them under evolution, then maybe we'd have the grounds for a proper comparison. So we are going to, this week, going to try to do that second project, compare classical theory as a theory that makes predictions about experiments to quantum theory and see where the differences really lie. So I want to get back to something we touched on earlier, which was this sort of tension between deterministic and indeterministic evolution, continuous and discontinuous evolution. And so earlier I mentioned that it's always possible when I have a system that is not isolated, that's coupled to some environment, to consider the larger system of system and environment and say that that's evolving unitarily. And my question is, I mean, does that fact make you worry about these postulates? There's a seed of a problem there. Yes?
Well, I don't see from these postulates how you can define how a subsystem would evolve, given how the entire system evolves. That's one point. The other is that in order to take, the only isolated system we know of is the entire universe.
Right.
If that isn't isolated.
Sure.
You do critically need to be able to define how this subsystem evolves given the overall evolution of an isolated system, if such a thing exists.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk at one point in the course about that sort of connection. So typically, there's something called a reduced density operator for a system, which is a mixed state rather than a pure state. And you can consider the evolution of that for a given evolution of the pure quantum state of the composite. But generally speaking, you even not knowing the details of that, you could say, well, if I have a composite system that's evolving deterministically and continuously, and if the state of the composite fixes the state of the subsystem, then it must be that that subsystem state is also evolving deterministically and continuously. And so the question is, is that in conflict somehow with these postulates?
The measurement system has to be a subsystem of some bigger system as well. And so evolution under measurement, if the evolution of the larger system fixes the evolution of the measurement system, then evolution under measurement should be continuous and deterministic as well.
Exactly. So yeah, that's something that a lot of people have pointed out. There seems to be not only a kind of inelegance of assuming dependent dynamics, but an outright inconsistency. Because on the one hand, you could say a measurement interaction is just like any other interaction. And the composite of the system that's being measured and the measurement device, you know, considered as a collection of atoms, that whole thing, you know, together with whatever else is interacting with it, that whole thing is evolving unitarily, deterministically and continuously. And that seems to be in contradiction with assuming that the system itself is evolving discontinuously and indeterministically. Yes?
And so that was in relation to consistency.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, unless I'm mistaken, it also doesn't seem like a closed set of axioms because it doesn't specify how you relate the operators with the act of measuring. So actually, you have these four postulates, but then an infinite list of things that you have to build by practice, like a list of relations between these abstract operators and the active measurement that you have to somehow add by common sense or something.
Yeah.
Unspecified.
I think you're right. That's roughly how it works, that there's sort of some guidelines for, you know, what Hermitian operator do I associate with this thing I've just built in my lab? And there's a long story about, you know, how you should do that. You know, like you have a picture that, oh, well, the electrons are coming in here, there's a magnetic field, that's going to cause them to curve. The place where I find them in the screen is going to tell me something about the momentum, therefore I'm measuring a momentum operator. But yeah, there's nothing in these postulates about how that all works. And in fact, a lot of it does rely heavily on these pictures of, you know, particles and classical physics and all that sort of stuff. You know, nonetheless, it's still well defined. I mean, there are some questions that people have asked we're not going to cover in this course, but questions like, is it the case that for any Hermitian operator I write down, it's possible to find a measurement device whose statistics are governed by that operator? And it turns out that there are some limitations. It's not quite the case that you can measure all Hermitian operators. Nicole.
Question about the inconsistency that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So when you were phrasing the question, I think you said, suppose that we have a composite system that's isolated, that's evolving deterministically. If the state and evolution of the entire system determine the state and evolution of each subsystem,
yep.
then why should we make that second assumption about how the whole system determines in the way that we want
yeah.
to say it does?
Yeah.
This
well,
system.
I would say that that seems to follow from the first postulate here. So suppose it were the case that the physical state, a complete description of the physical state of a composite system, was given by the Ray and Hilbert space that describes that composite system. And yet you want to tell me there's something about the subsystem that's not specified by that. Then it seems to me that given that the subsystem is part of the composite, I would have to admit that, okay, well, the composite isn't completely described by the quantum state. There's something else, you know, something about the subsystem which isn't captured by the quantum state or the composite. So if I wanted to say that there's something more to the subsystem, then, I mean, maybe we could argue about this, but it just seems that the most naive thing to say is that, well, you've given up on the notion that the rays of Hilbert space are a complete description, and you've tried to add something more. Does that answer your question?
How about evolution? I guess we would say something similar about the evolution of the isolated states as described by unitary operator U. Let's say the unitary operator U is supposed to be a complete representation of the evolution of the oscillated system and of every subsystem of that system.
Yeah, if the unitary U tells me everything about how the ray changes, and the ray tells me everything about the physical state, then there's nothing more to say about how the physical state changes. Okay, so I think we've covered a lot of good points. Let me reiterate some of them a bit more systematically. So the first problem which we identified was that the term measurement, which appears in these postulates, is not defined in terms of the more primitive notion of physical states of physical systems. And yet, isn't it the case that a measurement is just another kind of physical interaction? And there are, roughly speaking, two broad strategies that people have taken towards resolving that sort of problem. The first kind of strategy is what we discussed, that we might try to eliminate the term measurement as a primitive concept and try to reformulate quantum theory in terms of postulates that describe everything in terms of the physical states of the system. Okay, so the project of thinking of a measurement as not special, just another kind of interaction. The second strategy, on the other hand, says, well, actually, there's nothing wrong with having the term measurement in those postulates. It's the notion of talking about physical states of systems that's inappropriate. And this is what we should eliminate and just leave the postulates describing everything in operational terms, which means talking about what the outcomes of measurements are for certain preparation procedures and trying to make everything that you describe be in terms of macroscopic concepts that we could recognize as things we could do in the lab. And any reference to microscopic degrees of freedom and their properties get eliminated from the postulates. So there are prominent proponents for both these points of view. You might have heard of John Bell. So he was a realist, and a quote from one of his papers is here. So he complained that it would seem that quantum theory is exclusively concerned about the results of measurements and has nothing to say about anything else, but what exactly qualifies some physical system to play the role of measurer? So we already heard that complaint. Asher Perez was a prominent quantum theorist who wrote a really nice textbook, and the whole textbook takes the operational point of view. So he says, in a strict sense, quantum theory is a set of rules allowing the computation of probabilities for the outcomes of tests which follow specified preparations, and effectively nothing more. And if you try to add more to quantum theory, or think of it differently from this purely operational way, you'll get into trouble. So for the rest of this lecture, I'm going to adopt that realist strategy. So we're going to take that horn and say, suppose we want to describe everything in terms of the physical states of systems. But for the rest of the week, we're going to focus a lot on the operational approach. So let me go back over the inconsistencies of those orthodox postulates of quantum theory. This is, by the way, the interpretation that is suggested by the standard textbooks is sometimes just called the orthodox interpretation. this idea that, you know, measurements have indeterministic outcomes and there's two kinds of evolutions. Let's just refer to that set of things as the orthodox interpretation. And so the problems we found were some inconsistencies in that sort of interpretation. So the way we described it was that if you consider the evolution of a system to be governed by that fourth postulate, which is sometimes called the collapse postulate, then the evolution is indeterministic and discontinuous. However, if instead you say, let us consider the composite of the system being measured and the measurement device as an isolated system which is evolving unitarily, then it would seem that the system is evolving deterministically and continuously. Now, let me say a little bit more about that distinction. It's really a question of whether you want to treat the measurement procedure as an external intervention on the system or assign it dynamical degrees of freedom itself and model those within your theory. So it's really a question of whether you assign a Hilbert space and quantum states to the system, to the measurement apparatus, or treat it as just an external intervention. And that kind of distinction should be familiar to you, not just in quantum theory, but even in classical theories. So in a classical theory where I'm solving a dynamical problem, the example I like is, you know, bouncing a ball off a wall. I can assign degrees of freedom to the ball. It has a position. It has some equations of motion. And I have the choice of representing the wall as, say, an infinite potential barrier. And then I can just solve for the evolution of the ball in that potential. Or if I like, I can say, no, the wall is its own system. I'm going to assign it a mass. I'm going to assign it a position. I'm going to solve the equations of the motion for the ball and the wall interacting together. And as long as the wall, which is affixed to the Earth, is, you know, much more massive than the ball, then I can reproduce the predictions of my first model with the infinite potential to good approximation in my second model just by looking at the distance between the ball and the wall. So in a sense, these are just two perfectly valid ways of solving the same problem. It's not as if one is the correct way to solve the problem and the other is incorrect. They're just two different conventional choices for how to solve the problem, whether you treat the wall as an external potential or as a dynamical degree of freedom. And it's the same sort of thing here. Either, you know, over here, we're essentially treating the measurement device as an external intervention. Here, we're assigning it a Hilbert space and a quantum state and trying to figure out what happens in that sort of model. But it should be that these two things give exactly the same predictions. We wouldn't want our conventional choice of how to model the situation to determine, to affect what the predictions are. And yet, it would seem, according to this orthodox interpretation, that whether or not the evolution of the system is deterministic is changed by this conventional choice of how to model a measurement device. And whether or not it's continuous seems to be changed. And then there's one final inconsistency that people point to, having to do with whether the system that's being measured has determinate properties or not. So that's the last thing I'm going to go over. It's called the quantum measurement problem. And I mean, like many terms in foundations, they often have you know, different people use them different ways. So sometimes people talk about the quantum measurement problem as just being the problem we've already discussed, that it's sort of inappropriate for the term measurement to appear in the postulates. We should really try to define it in terms of something more primitive. But the quantum measurement problem also has a more technical meaning in the foundations literature, having to do with this particular inconsistency, which I'm now going to sketch out. And that's the way I'm going to use it here in its technical sense. So imagine you've got a simple experiment. This is just a Stern-Gerlach device. So over here I have an oven putting out something like a neutral silver atoms, which have a spin degree of freedom. So they're in some localized wave packet. They get passed through a magnet that has an inhomogeneous magnetic field, and that splits the wave packet into two components, depending on the component of spin along the z-axis of this particle. And then I have a screen here which detects it on either the upper or the lower path. And that teaches me something about what its spin along the z-axis was. OK, so if I model this in according to the collapse postulate, so I'm going to model the measurement apparatus externally, then I would say that the spin degree of freedom, if it initially is in this state, so some amplitude for being spin up along the z-direction, some amplitude for being spin down, then if the spin survives this whole ordeal, so let's say, you know, I manage after this detection to preserve the spin, then it gets collapsed to being spin up when I find it in the upper half plane. And it gets collapsed to spin down if I find it coming down. And each of these two events occurs with probability mod a squared and mod b squared, respectively. OK, that's standard stuff. What if I now treat the measurement apparatus internally? So I'm going to assign it a Hilbert space and a quantum state. And now I don't need to actually write down a detailed model of the complicated system of apparatus. I can just rely on that first postulate. Remember, the first postulate of the orthodox interpretation was that every physical state is associated one-to-one with a ray in Hilbert space. So even though I may not be able to tell you exactly what the Hilbert space of the apparatus is, or it may be too complicated, I can say, according to that first postulate, that there is some ray in a large Hilbert space which describes the apparatus at the beginning of the experiment, when it's ready to measure, it's ready to go. So I'm just going to represent that ray by this ket here, ready. We know it exists according to the first postulate. That's all that's going to be important for this argument. So we know now that if I start the apparatus off in its ready state and the spin is up, and I interact them together according to some, I know there's some unitary that's going to describe the apparatus, the interaction of the apparatus and the system. So I evolve them according to that unitary. Well, now I can say, under the assumption that the apparatus works well, this is really a measurement, it has to be that the state of the apparatus evolves to indicating up. So if I remember, if I fed in Z spin up into this device, I should always get, with probability 1, the outcome up revealed on my apparatus. So this equation here just tells me the apparatus is working properly. When you feed it in a spin up, it evolves to some new quantum state, which corresponds to the physical state of, you know, a pointer pointing in the up position. And again, although I may not be able to tell you exactly how to describe this, by postulate 1, there is some ray in Hilbert space that does this job, represents that state of the apparatus. OK, and then similarly, if the spin starts out down and the apparatus is ready, under the same unitary evolution, I should find that the apparatus goes into the state of indicating down. So yes, go ahead.
Does it follow from the axioms that subsystems must compose by a tensor product?
In the axioms I presented, the standard textbook axioms, I didn't have a separate point about tensor product, because most of these interpretational issues we're discussing today don't really rely on that. But a more complete set of axioms would say systems ought to compose by tensor product. Yeah. So later in the week, when we're looking at other axiom schemes, people are going to be, it's going to, we're going to be more focused on the tensor product structure. Yeah. Okay, so it's, any problems so far? Because I'm shortly going to drive a contradiction, so if you have any complaints about this, you should voice them now. Has everything I assumed seem reasonable given the orthodox postulates? Good? So now here's the critical bit, that any unitary operator is a linear operator, which means that if I take a coherent superposition with complex amplitudes A and B of two distinct states, psi and phi, then this equation holds. So in words, the unitary evolute, right, so this thing here is a state, the unitary evolute of this superposition is the same superposition of the evolutes of each of the component states. Okay, so if I have that, then I can say what happens when I feed in this coherent superposition of spin up and spin down in this description of treating the apparatus internally. So I take the superposition tensor, the apparatus in its ready state. I apply the unitary to this. So all I've done here is distribute ready over the two terms of this superposition. So that's just a bit of manipulation. And then I use this linearity and the fact that, you know, each of these equations to derive this, that at the end, the quantum state is just going to be a coherent superposition of system Z spin up, tensor apparatus indicates up, system Z spin down, apparatus indicates down. And now the problem here is that this is not what we would normally consider to be a state that predicted that there was a definite spin for the system, either up or down. Why is that? Well, typically the way we do quantum mechanics, we say a property like spin or position or momentum is only well defined for a system if the quantum state of that system is an eigenstate of the operator associated with that property. So typically you'd say Z spin is only a well defined property for those quantum states that are eigenstates of Z spin. Now, if you have a state like this one here, which is not a state of the spin alone, but a state of a larger system, the spin and the apparatus, you can still ask about the spin of the system by looking at this operator on the larger space. It's just the Z spin for the system, tensor identity for the apparatus. So that's basically saying, I don't care what's about the properties of the apparatus at all. I'm only caring about the spin. So the question then becomes, is this quantum state an eigenstate of that operator? And so if you just acted on the quantum state, and you distribute the Z spin operator throughout, you get a positive eigenvalue for this term and a negative eigenvalue for this term. And therefore, this guy here, this final state, is not proportional to the state you're acting on. So there's no lambda for which this is the case, which just means that the state's not an eigenstate of Z spin. So by our normal way of reasoning, we would say, right, so Z spin is not a well-defined property for this kind of quantum state. And that's problematic because if we had treated the measurement apparatus externally, we predicted that the final state should have Z spin as a property, either Z spin up or Z spin down with certain probabilities. Whereas here what we seem to be predicting is that no, the final state of the system just doesn't have Z spin as a property at all. And so this is why on the previous slide I said that in this sort of model it seems that systems have determinate properties, so Z spin is a determinate property here, but it's not a determinate property here. And that seems like an inconsistency. Again, our choice of how to model the measurement should not affect what our predictions are. In particular, it shouldn't affect whether we think certain properties are determinate or not. Let me say one final thing about this, which is that if you want to make it more dramatic, you can use Schrodinger's cat as your example. So suppose that you hook up your Stern-Gerlach device such that the outcome here triggers, you know, the hammer which breaks the flask of poison, which either kills the cat or not inside the box. In that case, when you looked at this final superposition that we derived, you would have now three systems. You would start out with something tensor, cat alive, and then you would evolve to a term which was, you know, spin up, apparatus indicates up, cat alive, plus spin down, apparatus indicates down, cat dead. Whereas over here, you would just predict that, you know, with some probability the cat would be alive and some probability the cat would be dead. And then you'd again have this conflict that over here, it would seem that the cat does not have a property of being alive or dead. Right? So I could, just like I wrote down that spin operator, I could write down an operator that sort of picked out the life versus death property. And this would not be an eigenstate of that operator. So you'd say, no, that the cat does not have that property, whereas here it does. And what's odd about that is that whereas you might have thought that it's okay at the microscopic level to have things that just don't have any Z spin, it's not a determinate property. Schrodinger used the language that, you know, this kind of state is sort of smeared out between these two possibilities, Z up and Z down. And you might have thought that's not a problem at the microscopic level. But when you amplify it to the macroscopic level of an apparatus, and you say that an apparatus does not have a definite property of indicating some result, but is only smeared out between two different results, that starts to sound in conflict with what we observe in the lab, that apparatuses and cats do seem to have determinate properties. So that's the standard way that people have formulated the measurement problem. Okay. So yeah, back to there. So we don't have much time left. Let me suggest that I, again, open it up to you for ways that you might get around these problems. So we saw those orthodox postulates. I've tried to argue that there's some inconsistencies in those orthodox postulates. And my question now is, how might we modify them to resolve those inconsistencies? And I have a list of options that people have pursued. And so I'm just asking you guys to tell me what might be on that list.
Interpreting the second case, so the one with the superposition and the non-determinant state, in such a way that you actually get the same as the first situation. In other words, reinterpreting what quantum mechanics is about. So basically talking about ignorance. So then there's no contradiction. In the sense that you never say anything is indeterminate. You only say something, you're always talking about ignorance in both cases.
So if I want to talk about ignorance, I guess it'd be ignorance of the physical state.
Yes.
If the quantum state represents the physical state completely,
that's
possible.
What I'm trying to say is that reinterpreting the quantum state as being about ignorance, and then both situations are compatible, because...
Okay, well, if you want to do that, I think I understand what you're saying. Let's reject the first postulate. Let's say that quantum state is not a complete description of the reality of the system, but rather maybe a description of what we know about some hidden variables, then it seems like you could potentially overcome this, because there might actually not be a contradiction between these two ways of representing things. If this is not saying something like, oh, the apparatus is in some funny physical state corresponding to being both this and that in superposition, whatever that means, but rather this is just a state of my knowledge saying, well, there's some deeper description wherein the apparatus really is indicating up or down, but when my knowledge is described by this Ray and Hilbert space, I don't know which it is. But there's some deeper description of the physical state which does resolve that ambiguity. Yeah, that's certainly one way out, the sort of hidden variable approach. Other suggestions for how to get out of the inconsistency? Yes?
Well, if we say that the postulate regarding unitary evolution is only valid for a system that is truly isolated, and the only system that's truly isolated is the entire universe, and therefore anything that we have in the lab is actually not isolated, it's been acting on by the environment, then the environment can act on the whole measurement apparatus plus thing being measured system. And when we get that superposition in the last step, that actually collapses almost immediately to either an up or a down, because there's something collapsing the whole system.
Good. Let me talk a bit about that. Let's see if I have something like this. Let me maybe go through this here. So sometimes people suggest the following. They say, let's consider another system, an environment, which we'll represent by E naught, which interacts with the spin in the apparatus. So depending on the state of the spin in the apparatus, the environment goes into one of two different states. And the question is, can this help? Later in the course, we're going to hear about reduced density operators. And if you calculate the reduced density operator for the apparatus in this kind of state, it's no longer a coherent superposition, but an incoherent superposition. And people sometimes suggested that we should then interpret this as a probabilistic mixture, as one or the other. But the problem with that is that, again, if you really are committed to the notion that the quantum state represents the physical state completely, so the composite of spin, apparatus, and environment has all of its properties described by this quantum state, well, there's nothing in this quantum state that breaks the symmetry, that picks out one term over the other. So to then say, the apparatus really is one or the other, is really to deny that first postulate, to say there's something more to be said about the apparatus than is said by the pure state of the composite system. So although it has sometimes been suggested that decoherence with an environment can solve the measurement problem, that's not quite right if you want to stick with that first postulate of formalism. So you could say, well, we have to abandon that postulate, and we have to look at interpretations where the quantum state's not everything, and maybe decoherence can help us in those interpretations pick out what sorts of properties systems have. And that's fine. That is a certain kind of approach to resolving these inconsistencies. But it certainly doesn't maintain those orthodox postulates. It violates principle one. And we are going to talk a bit in the last week about those kinds of approaches. I should maybe also mention, sort of connected to your comment, let me just go back. Von Neumann famously pointed out that it doesn't matter where you put the cut between what's treated internally and what's treated externally. So suppose I treat the apparatus here internally, as I did here, but now I imagine another apparatus on the outside looking in on this one, maybe with a video camera and recording the pointer position, and I treat that other apparatus externally. Well, then it looks in at this thing, and then according to postulate two, I guess it was, it's going to, or four, it's going to collapse this quantum state onto one or the other term when it measures it. And so von Neumann said, okay, that's good news because it means there's a consistency between all the places where we can put the cut. That's fine. But the point that the realists make is that in reality, we don't need to put the cut anywhere. We could treat everything internally, the whole universe, as you said. And that's when we have a problem because then there's nothing on the outside left to induce that collapse. Okay, so we have two kinds of hidden variable types of approaches. But there are other alternatives. There are approaches to quantum theory that don't assume any hidden variables. Yes?
The many worlds interpretation.
Okay.
So you basically regard everything as a unitary evolution. And then like the superposition that you see at the on the last line basically occurs in two different realities.
Right. So the idea of the many worlds interpretation is throw in the observer as another dynamical system. So I'll assign a Hilbert space to observer. I'll start out here with a tensor observer, you know, ready to observe. And then if the apparatus and the observer are working correctly, then the observer should go into a state of having observed the pointer to say up. And here they go into a state of having observed the apparatus to indicate down. And if the spin starts out in a coherent superposition and the observer is ready to observe, then the whole thing leaves you in a superposition of spin up, apparatus indicate up, observer sees the apparatus indicating up, plus spin down, apparatus indicates down, observer observes the apparatus indicate down. And then the question is, what would an observer in that kind of physical state experience? Right? So we're going to stick to the first postulate and say that big ray in Hilbert space completely describes the physical state of the apparatus and the observer. And then the question is, well, it's such an unfamiliar kind of physical state. How do we know what you would experience in that kind of state? And Everett's idea was that although the reality has, you know, really is described by the full state, objectively, subjectively, there are two perspectives in the universe. There's kind of a sort of a parallel universe. There's sort of an observer that has the perspective of the term in the first branch, and there's another observer that has the perspective of the term in the second branch. So there's one observer out there who sees up and another observer in parallel who sees down. And subjectively to them, it looks like collapses are happening. But objectively, no collapses are happening. Everything is existing in parallel. So in the last week, we're going to see the many worlds interpretation in more detail and some of the problems with that interpretation. Okay, so hidden variables, many worlds. There's another prominent one. Yes?
You could change the dynamical law and actually make two distinct laws and say there is a cut off depending on certain specifics of the system.
Yes, exactly. You could try to say, well, we just need to be clearer on exactly where the cut lies. We need to make a fundamental distinction between two kinds of systems, some of which evolve unitarily, as quantum mechanics is typically formulated. But there's a different kind of dynamical law for these systems on the other side of the cut. And somehow these two dynamics are consistent and they yield, they're consistent with those postulates we saw. So that's another, you call that the hybrid dynamics approach. And that's actually the first one on my list. Let me go to my list and then finish up. There's one other which is related to that. The idea you mentioned was basically to deny the universality of quantum dynamics. So there was an assumption in those postulates that unitary dynamics is universal. All systems evolve according to this unitary dynamical law. But you could deny that. You could say it's not the universal law of dynamics. And so one way to do that is to imagine that there's sort of a quantum classical hybrid dynamics, that you have a cut, and some systems evolve according the unitary evolution law, and systems on the other side of the cut evolve in a more classical or probabilistic way. Now, the people have worked on these sorts of models, but I would say that there really hasn't been much success, that there are some strong no-go theorems about having consistent dynamics with two sorts of systems that couple one another, one of which evolves in a quantum way, and the other of which evolves in a classical way. So roughly speaking, there hasn't been much success in generating models of this sort. There have been a lot of speculations about where the cut might lie, and people have said things such as, well, maybe it's sort of sentience, that, you know, sentient observers are on one side of the cut, and they undergo different dynamics than physical systems. But again, not a lot of details in these sorts of models. The other kind of model, they've had a lot more success. So this sort of, they're called collapse models. They also deny the universality of the quantum evolution law, but they don't invoke a cut. They say, no, every system in the universe evolves in exactly the same way, but that evolution is not quite unitary. So an example is, imagine that things evolve unitarily, but once every billion years, they get spontaneously localized. So that's a kind of different discontinuous collapse dynamics where they suddenly become localized. Well, that sort of dynamics actually fits nicely with the orthodox postulates, because if I look at any of the experiments that have been done that vindicate unitary dynamics, so like tabletop experiments of interference, I wouldn't expect to see any deviation from regular quantum theory if the particles in my experiment only collapse once every billion years, because, you know, that's going to be so infrequent, it won't affect my statistics. But if I have a very large system that has 10 to the 23 particles in it, then, as we'll see in the last week, the way it works is that you only need one of those systems to be localized in order for all of them to become localized. So if I have, you know, all the particles in my measurement apparatus are in a superposition of being either here or here, if I localize just one of them, they all get localized. And so what that means is that with 10 to the 23 particles, if one of them is localized every billion years, then the whole thing tends to get localized incredibly quickly. So the dynamics for a large composite system in this sort of model is radically different, and it simulates the kind of collapse dynamics we saw in the fourth postulate. So we're going to hear a lot about those collapse models in the last week. Well, maybe not a lot, but a bit. So anyways, the rest of the list is deny the representational completeness of the quantum state. So this is basically hidden variables. And what we'll see next week is there's sort of a distinction among hidden variable models based on whether you take the quantum state to be part of the description of reality, just not the whole description. Those are called psiontic models. And another kind of model wherein the quantum state is not part of the description of reality, it's merely a description of what you know about the hidden variables. And then, of course, there's denying that this appearance of the unique outcome is really the case. And that's Everett's many worlds interpretation, which we heard a bit about. One thing we didn't come up, and which we're not really going to see much of in the course, is that there's a tradition of imagining that perhaps some aspect of classical logic or classical probability theory has to fail. So classical logic, roughly speaking, is a branch of epistemology. It tells us how we ought to make deductions, how we ought to reason without making mistakes. So it's sort of the theory of right reasoning. And this idea is that perhaps the innovation that quantum mechanics requires is not an innovation to physics, but an innovation to logic and how we ought to reason. Similarly, people have expressed the idea that maybe quantum mechanics is an innovation on classical probability theory. So you can think of classical probability theory as the theory of how to reason correctly in the presence of incomplete information and uncertainty. And it might be that it's that which needs to be generalized. And then finally, there's always the possibility that there's some other feature of this realist framework we've been working in, maybe one that we haven't articulated explicitly, and it's that that has to go, and that none of these approaches are quite right, or that no one of them really captures everything that we need to get the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics. Okay, that's it for today.